Hey, so we're here with Nick McKinley with the Deliver Fund, and we've been friends for a number of years. I remember when you first came to Calvary and introduced yourself, I went, there is no way this guy does what he does, but you do.
Yeah.
So.
What do you do?
I do a bunch of things. It's like when people ask me, like, what do you do for a living? I'm like, well, that's complicated.
Yes.
Who are you? And then that will help me tailor what it is that I do. So
I like that answer.
Number one, the Deliver Fund truly is hunters of human traffickers.
Yes.
And you use technology mostly.
Yes.
You use technology to get you there. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about that without giving up all your secrets?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we can talk about pretty much everything that we do. So, and it's because the methodology that we use and have created creates a Hobson's choice for the trafficker. One of the things that people don't understand is that when we talk about human trafficking and we think about some of the modern narratives around human trafficking, especially like, you know, the Sound of Freedom movie that just came out.
Mm.
If you live in Guatemala or Mexico or Colombia, that's a very relevant narrative to you. Mm-hmm. If you live in the United States or any other westernized countries, that is not a relevant narrative, right? It's not the white van with free candy painted on the side of it that's going through a neighborhood trying to kidnap a child. When you look at the data around human trafficking, which, you know me, I'm the biggest nerd that there is and a huge data guy. That we look at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they have the best data in the U.S. when it comes to child abductions, trafficking, all those types of things. And they, when you look at the data, you find that there's a 0.0001% chance of a child being abducted by a stranger in the United States.
Mm.
That's roughly the same chance that a child has to be struck by lightning. Now, looking at that same data, you find that 92%, and this is something you two know extremely well, 92% of the missing kids in their data are what they call endangered runaways, which is a fancy way of saying a predator contacted the child online, usually through social media, gaming console, something like that, and then manipulated them over a period of months to sometimes even years, and then convinced them to run away and into the arms of what they thought was somebody who's going to take care of them and solve all their problems and fill that God-sized hole in their heart. But instead, what happened was they ran into the arms of a trafficker. That's the reality of human trafficking in the United States. And also looking at the NCMEC data, they found that over a five-year period, they had an 846% increase in suspected child trafficking cases in just 5 years, which is essentially a 846% increase in a market in just 5 years. And why? Broadband connected microcomputers that are in everybody's pockets and that we give to children, which then gives all of the predators in the country access to all of the children who have a smartphone or any type of internet connected device. So that's the problem that we fight and we solve at Deliver Fund is these traffickers are advertising online. We find those advertisements. There's on over 30 different websites on the front-facing internet. This is not a deep web, dark web issue. This is the front-facing internet. So we collect that data, over 4 billion data points that we've collected so far. Yeah.
Wow.
We've got our own supercomputers. Actually, one of them is hosted here in New Mexico at a facility. You guys don't have any natural disaster issues really to worry about here. Like, we don't have to worry about floods. We don't have to worry about hurricanes. We don't have to worry about anything that's going to knock out the internet. So we've got one of our backups here. But what when you're collecting billions of data points and you're collecting all of that information and you're collecting it as fast as we are, you end up with this big data problem. And so we build essentially our own AI and our own filters that then crawl through that data and help us find the signal that we're looking for. And then we provide that to law enforcement. We have an app that will allow us to provide that to parents and caregivers and directly to kids who have a social media account. and have a smartphone.
You know, it's people make fun of us, or my kids get made fun of, that we don't give them phones. We don't give them smartphones until they're at a very respectable age and very well educated. But truly, when you give your kid a smartphone, you're giving a predator a key to their door.
Absolutely. We have so many, especially fathers, who, you know, take this approach of like, I'm going to protect my family, and so I've got all these guns, and I go to the gym to work on my guns, and I put these fancy locks on my door, and I've got cameras. And then the kind of narrative, you know, I grew up with four sisters, right, in the 80s and 90s, so I kind of get it a little bit. Every father and mother at some point in a young girl's life have an argument with them about them not being able to dress inappropriately, going to insert wherever kids go to these days, right? In my day, it was the mall. Yeah. I don't know where it is now, right? But that argument happens. Mm-hmm. And then it usually ends up in some type of go to your room or some type of isolated event under the umbrella of those parents. Mm. And they think, oh, well, our child is safe because they're in our home. Meanwhile, they're chatting with a human trafficker on the phone that they gave them that's acting as a babysitter or acting as a distractor. And that's the problem. And so, yes, when you give a child, and when I say child here, I really mean anybody under the age of 18, you have a child a smartphone, you're giving all of the predators in the world, not just the U.S., but all of the ones in the world who have the capacity to manipulate a young person, access to your young person.
So you have a young lady mad at her dad, goes online, someone shows her compassion, and they're trained. I'm sure that they hold training sessions on how to sell a child to lure them in.
Oh, they do. It's a business. And I think that's one of the things that's very important to understand, and one of the issues that's different about Deliver Fund versus kind of other groups that try to fight human trafficking. And there's lots of them. You do a great job here in New Mexico. You've got one called New Mexico.
Dream Center.
Dream Center. Yeah. Right. Great organization. Yes. Shelly's been in the fight for a long
time.
Yeah. But when you look at the restoration homes and things like that, one of the kind of hard truths is restoration homes do not fight human trafficking.
Right.
It's they're an incredibly important part, and those people are.
These are the people that catch them after they've already
fallen victim. Yeah, these are the people who
victim.
Restore the victims back to a healthy existence. And I tell you, that work is so hard. I couldn't do it. That's not the skill set that God gave me. But that doesn't fight human trafficking, because that's cleaning it up, right? That's the cancer surgeon. What we need to do is actually prevent the cancer in the first place, and that is by going after the human traffickers. Because without a human trafficker, you cannot have a human trafficking victim. And that was why I started Deliver Fund, was because I saw that gap in the market. And also, there was no real effort to fight human trafficking at the scale of the problem. There's these onesies and twosies, right? Helping law enforcement over here, helping law enforcement over there. But the reason, as we talked about before, that we had such an explosion in child trafficking in America is because of technology and because of internet-connected technologies. So if we know why it happened, well, then we know how to fight it to reduce that scale and bring it back down to where it was pre-internet.
Now, I want our listeners to know, Nick, you were ex-Special Forces.
No, ex-Pararescue.
Yeah, they're special forces. They're badass soldiers.
So special forces is U.S. Army.
Oh.
I was special operations forces.
He's getting technical. Let me just say this.
To my special forces brothers out there, those are Green Berets.
So my listeners know, he's a badass soldier, super bad. And then you were recruited by the CIA.
Yes. Yeah.
And now you're hunting human traffickers, and you're using everything you learned there, and you're surrounding yourself with like-minded people like that.
I am. However, we're starting to shift a little bit, because what I found is that we're taking the counterterrorism methodologies that we learned, you know, in Pararescue and then in the CIA, and the combination of my personnel recovery training in Pararescue and then my counterterrorism training in the CIA, like, really works well for the counter human trafficking fight. And I'm using some pretty specific language here, but when we talk about human trafficking, we have anti-human trafficking, which is very similar to anti-terrorism. It's what prevents it, right? So the anti-human trafficking initiatives are education, but we have more education awareness of human trafficking now than we've ever had in the history of the world, and yet the problem continues to grow. So we know based on data that that doesn't work. It's not that it's not important. We don't need to continue to do it. But it's not having the effect that anybody would think it does. So we've got education, and that's anti-human trafficking, right? So the prevention of. The best anti-human trafficking out there is be a good dad, be a good parent. That's the best anti-human trafficking, right? Then from there, you have what we call counter-human trafficking, which is where you're actually countering the act of human trafficking. And that's really where we sit at Deliver Fund, is not only helping our law enforcement partners, but then also people in society. So it used to be that, yes, I only really hired people with a special ops background, people with an intelligence background. And what I found actually was that I started bringing in these really young interns, people in college, and they were savants. And they were so much better with the technology than a lot of the people coming out of the government. Because in the government, if you need something, right, they build it for you, or they go contract somebody to build it for you, right? The defense industrial complex.
They hire that
young
person to build it for
you. Yeah, right? And then all they are doing is using it, extremely well supported, right? Mm-hmm. So you look at the JSOC and SOCOM and agency teams, they're incredibly well supported. Well, we're a small nonprofit, you know, donor funded. So we don't exactly have access to those resources. And so these young people who grew up in a era where they don't know the world without an iPad, not just an iPhone, an iPad. Right? We remember iPad Gen 1. I remember iPhone Gen 1. I was an early adopter of all that stuff. And still, these folks, it's just intuitive. And so these young kids that we've been bringing in are doing a great job. But then we also found there's a lot of people with law enforcement backgrounds and just a lot of very well, just very bright stay-at-home moms and dads who, you know, want to moonlight helping their local law enforcement. And so we have a program that we're releasing at the end of January called our OLX program, which is based on a military special ops program where we'll be able to, like, let's say you want to start OLX ABQ. You can actually go sign up. You got to jump through a lot of hoops because we got to make sure that we get the right people in there. And then we'll give you access to our technology and data, train you how to use it, and then all you have to do is go implement. So there's lots of people who know how to use the technology and the data. They don't need to be tech wizards. We have tech wizards to go build it.
Yeah.
All they have to do is have a passion for this.
So it's more grassroots then. So it would be, sign
little
us up.
Plug and play.
Yeah, that's that, and that's how we fight human trafficking at the scale of the problem. And that's always been the issue, is human trafficking has turned into such a large issue, and the scale is so big now that how could one organization possibly get to the bottom of it?
Right.
You can't. So you've got to have boots on the ground in all these cities all over the country doing that work and helping their law enforcement partners, but then also protecting their community.
You know, and if Michelle used to run the boutique and with Zoe, and most of the girls that came in that were arrested for auto theft, for instance, were actually trafficked victims. And you dealt with it one-on-one. And when we talked then, it was wonderful that we were some of the people. My wife was one of the women that were catching them after they came out. And the intel that you can get from that helps people like you. But you, like you said, you remove inventory from the shelf, they're just going to refill the shelf.
Right.
But if we take away the store owner, or in this case, the trafficker, the whole operations shuts down. But it's so important that everybody does their part. If everybody took a little bit of time and learned a little bit and then did what they could do to change it, it would change it, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. I think if we had every... Well, one, there's the whole lack of positive male role models, right? That's the biggest issue when it comes to human trafficking. Major majority of trafficking victims are young girls, preteen and teen girls, and the research around the the father's influence in their lives is not even up for debate. It is a statement of fact now. And while mothers are more important in the earlier years, we know from research that the fathers are more important in the secondary years until they leave. So without that positive male role model, we're going to have lots and lots of problems as that continues to get worse. That's not an issue I'm addressing. I'll speak on, but it's a, you know, that's really the issue that the church should be primarily focused on.
Right.
Then you have the, okay, education awareness about how it works. And then you have the actual action, if you will, against it. So that's everything from politicians creating legislation around CDA 230 and the Communications Decency Act Rule 230, which needs significant overhauls, and creating legislation around what social media companies can and cannot do as far as targeting children algorithmically. We need more of that. We need that happening at the state and local level. Actually, in New Mexico, your AG is doing an awesome job going after, and I know a lot of people listening to this probably don't particularly like him, and he and I definitely have some worldview differences, but he is doing a great job in going after these social media companies. In fact, he led the country. Your DA here in Bernalillo County, your AG, who used to be your DA in Bernalillo County, right? Your AG is leading the country in that, and then even my AG in Montana is now joining him. So good.
That's,
you know, politicians getting involved. Well, how do politicians get involved? Well, we as the voters have to mandate that our politicians get involved. You go to your mayor and here in Albuquerque and you say, hey, tell me about your feelings about fighting human trafficking. And he's going to say, oh, it's the most important thing. And, you know, it's my top priority and all that stuff. The very next question out of a person's mouth should be, show me the budget line item that funds your human trafficking unit. And then there's going to be lots of wringing of hands and mashing of teeth, right? And so, but if we as voters need to hold our politicians accountable to actually providing the resources to fight human trafficking and take the issue seriously, then we have, you know, everybody from the $5 Instagram donor to the nonprofits that are actively doing the work, all the way to high net worth individuals. Cutting those checks to those organizations that are doing that work, because they're in business, you know, 60, 70 hours a week. Simultaneously, you have somebody else who's protecting their children 60, 70 hours a week. And if they think that they're doing it on their own, they're lying to themselves. So, you know, high net worth individuals all the way down to the, you know, the college kid donating $5 a month to the nonprofits that are doing the good work. And then for our law enforcement officers as well, and supporting our law enforcement officers to actually go out there and go after the traffickers.
We have some amazing units here locally.
Yes. Yeah, we do. You guys do. You're lucky. The piece that's always been missing, and the piece that we're also addressing, is industry. So human traffickers, they book plane tickets. They book Greyhound bus tickets. They get Ubers. They get hotel rooms. They open bank accounts. They get insurance. Mm-hmm. They do all of the same things you and I do. They have phones. They have lots of phones. Right? They open Facebook accounts and Instagram accounts. So that same data that we're using to help the public, and then a broader set of data that we're using to help law enforcement, can also be used to fight human trafficking within industry. So we have a number of banks that have been using our data. Airbnb uses our data. Verafin NASDAQ is starting to implement our data into their anti-money laundering practices. And so if we can make it so that traffickers can't get a Facebook account, they can't get an Instagram account, and if they do, they can't get a bank account, and they can't get a they can't order an Uber, and they can't get a hotel room, and they can't get a plane ticket, that's really going to reduce the size of the market. And that's one of the things that we're very focused on.
So the darkness of human trafficking, right? We all know, I don't think there's a parent out there that doesn't think it's bad, but there's other things that come with that. If we can chop off that snake's head, we're chopping off the head of multiple other things. Do you guys address any of those, or are you staying 100% focused on human trafficking?
So Deliver Fund is 100% focused on human trafficking. I'm working on another initiative with with some partners in DC about addressing some other illicit commodity issues. And I can really get into the nerdery of, you know, illicit commodity markets and, you know, gray and black markets and how the whole thing works. But look at it this way. When we all want to reduce demand, because I hear that a lot. Well, it's supply and demand, and traffickers, if there wasn't a demand, we wouldn't have such a need for supply. And fundamentally, all of that is actually true, right? So the demand issue is a big deal. However, how are we going to change the demand issue? Like, let's be very pragmatic about that. And until we can change the hearts of men, which ain't going to happen, Nick McKinley has no ability to do that, right? Neither do you. And so that's really something that the church is working on. We can ask whether or not the church is working on it to the appropriate level. Yes, there's all kinds of bigger conversations for the theologians to have. But ultimately, we're dealing with a hearts of men issue. So we're not going to change that. All right, well, let's look at math. Let's look at what the data says. Let's look at what the math says. We know that the math in the science around supply and demand curves is very well established. It is not up for argument. Every economist in the world knows that how you reduce demand and how you increase demand or get demand at essentially its equilibrium, is what economists call it. Well, there's these things called externalities, and they can be positive or negative. As business owners, you know that as friction and risk.
Right.
It's that simple. Mm-hmm. And so what did you do in trying to sell things to customers? You try to make it as easy as possible for them to buy it. You try to make it a seamless, frictionless experience. You try to mitigate your risks everywhere you can in having backups in your supply chain and insurance and all that stuff. Well, if that's what you do, so those are positive externalities that you try to use to make it easy for your customers to purchase. That's what gets the demand up. The inverse is also true. If you increase friction and risk, then you create what's called deadweight loss in the market, which decreases demand. And that's not up for debate. That is.
No, it's proven.
It's proven. We know that.
So if you make it more difficult, then
an increased
demand
risk
is going to go down.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that's where working with industry, working, you know, putting the power in the hands of the public and parents through things like our app, working with law enforcement, but then also that's where your regulation and your legislation comes in. And so imagine if every person who is under the age of 18 who got a Facebook account had to prove their identity. I mean, anonymity on the internet is actually one of the biggest problems we have. And there's great arguments on both sides of the aisle as to why anonymity on the internet is okay, but also why it has led to so a lot of what we're doing. A lot of it comes down to this personal responsibility. People want to be able to essentially be jerks online and not be held accountable for it.
Yeah.
People act online very different than they act in the real world, in the physical world, and they want to continue to get away with that.
I'm nicer online.
I bet you are, actually. But I would say that's probably because you are online under your real identity. Mm-hmm. You're not 1234XYZ, you know, at Instagram. And so that's lack of essentially people with very little character, low morals, low ethics, who just want to go online and be trolls, right? And those are, I mean, for the most part, terrible human beings who are making the world a significantly worse place. And they hit me up. They're constantly talking trash about me online, right? Which to me, I'm like, that just feeds me.
Right.
That just
that's good publicity.
Yeah. I'm like, go ahead. You know, in fact, there was an article that came out in a major publication about some of the stuff that we were doing at Deliver Fund and saying that we were violating people's privacy and we were, you know, we were uncovering victims and all of this different stuff. And I was like, wow. And the two people that they brought out against me, one was I don't remember exactly what she called herself, but it was something, she was like a transvestite witch. And then the other one was works for this terrible organization called Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF, right? I mean, that's like the heart of evil when it comes to the internet. And so my wife read the article and she's like, so let me get this straight. The people coming out against you is a self-proclaimed witch. Prostitute.
Yeah.
And a transvestite witch. She's like, I think you're doing the right things.
So true. Hey, so you guys came up with this app and you launched it 8 months ago?
Something like that.
Something close, right? Yeah. Tell us about it.
So if you just go to the App Store or the Google Play Store, I think it's called, and you can download an app called HT Safeguard, stands for Human Trafficking Safeguard, or you can just Google or just search Deliver Fund. There's also links on our website at deliverfund.org.
And we'll have a link below.
Yeah.
Where you can find that. But essentially, when you look at human trafficking in America, the major majority of the human trafficking is commercial sex in nature. And that is advertised online. And so if you have a phone number, like let's say you're a young girl gets hit up by somebody on Instagram and they're chatting with them. And then what the predators will always do, and I use the word predator in conjunction with trafficker because traffickers are societal predators.
Yes. Oh, no, we like, don't argue.
Yeah, trust me, there's been plenty of people online who are trying to argue with me. I'm like, this is just, you're dumb.
Ridiculous.
So these are societal predators, right? And it doesn't matter if they're a trafficker or they're a child, you know, they're trying to exploit a child for their own gratification. These are all predators. And so these predators advertise online and they screw up. They accidentally put down their real phone number on an advertisement when they meant to put down their burner phone. Or they have a whole group of burner phones, but they actually put this girl's burner phone under this girl's picture, or they can't keep it straight.
It's complicated.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, as a you know former professional spy, I mean, trained in this stuff at the highest levels there is, we would screw that stuff up all the time. Now, when you've got the government, you're just like, okay, I'll just get a new phone. It's not that big of a deal, but if we screwed it up all the time at being selected at that level, how often do you think traffickers and the predators screw it up? These are not particularly bright people. They screw it up all the time. So what we know is that if there's an advertisement online for commercial sex services, and it's escorts or whatever, but we all know what it really is, and so... there's that advertisement, there's a phone number and email address. Because, and this is the Hobson's choice that I talked about in the beginning, traffickers have to advertise. They have to in order to do business at the scale that they need to do business to make the money that they need to make. And so if they need to do business at scale, they have to advertise online. And if you advertise online, you have to give somebody the ability to contact you. Now, there's a lot of myths and rumors that, oh, this is deep and dark web. Two very well-educated professionals sitting in front of me. Mm. Do you know how to get on the dark web?
I don't.
You just Google search.
I call you and ask you how to get on the dark web.
It's pretty complicated, actually. In fact, I had the wife of a pastor who was doing a message for a bunch of women on Rahab. And so she was researching prostitution, and she called me. She's like, Nick, I'm doing this research, but I want to make sure that I don't stumble into the dark web. And I was like, and so I said, saying stumbling into the dark web is like saying that you accidentally stumbled into a bank vault when it was locked after hours. Mm. Like it's a very, very deliberate set of processes that get you there. Mm-hmm. And so the point is there's not a lot of customers on the dark web. So traffickers have to advertise on the public-facing, front-facing internet. And so they have to give an ability for the customer to contact them, which is a phone number, an email address, sometimes a social media handle, but 90% of the time it's a phone number and email address. So we harvest all that data, and then we make it searchable through that app. So if you, again, back to that young girl, she gets the DM, then they try to do what we call off-platforming, which is they take her from one platform to another. So usually something encrypted. Facebook just made all of their messages encrypted, which is actually a really bad thing. Mm. So they'll take them to something like Signal or WhatsApp or something else, or even just text message, right? And they'll start texting with them. And that requires a phone number or an email address usually. So when that, let's say, 16-year-old girl gets that phone number, she could then put it into our app. And if it comes back as a positive hit for a commercial sex advertisement, you know you have a potential problem. Mm. You don't know for sure that you have a trafficker. That number could have been transferred somewhere else, but you know,
it's not a good,
as a statement of fact, you have a commercial sex advertisement with that phone number on it. That is a true statement. Well, that gives you, it should give anybody room for pause. And that's why we created that app, is because if you have that set of circumstances, you know you've got a potential problem. Now, that not getting a positive hit in our app is not a is not an excuse to not be diligent, but it's at least it's a monitor, it's a sensor that allows you to see whether or not you've got this potential problem. And when we look at the issue, it's predominantly around that commercial sex advertising space. If you shut down commercial sex advertising, you would see a probably 80% decrease in human trafficking in America. That's how big of an issue that one keystone in the bridge is. And so if we remove that, or at least make it so that people can access the information that they need in order to make decisions. Now, some of the pushback we get is, well, wait a minute, why do we have to, you know, download your app? We do charge for it. It's $1.99 a month. Yep. I don't think we're being egregious here. But also, we built it with donor dollars. So thanks to the generosity of our donors, we're able to build what is a very sophisticated app when you look at the back-end technologies. However, we don't want to continue to have to go to donors over and over and over to keep it going. And so everybody's, you know, $24 a year is, you know, paying into helping to keep the servers running. But you can find all the information you can find in our app just through Google searches. It'll take you anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes. You're going to have to do some very customized Google searches. So my guess is you probably don't know how to do that.
Right.
90% of the public does not know how to do that. The problem, though, is that if you do that through Google, it's going to take you to very explicit websites where you will be exposed to very graphic content, and usually you will be exposed to pornography. So the reason that we created the app is we, one, don't want parents being exposed to that. But if you have a young girl who wants to use the app to screen the people in her network, we also don't want her being exposed to any of this pornographic material. And so this allows you to get the information you need, get the positives without any of the negatives of being exposed to any of the graphic material.
And it raises awareness.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, switching gears a little bit. If we go back to a time when we were taking our troops and our people out of the Middle East, there were people left behind.
There were lots of people left behind.
One of those.
It's almost like we chose to lose a war.
I'm just saying.
Staying away from the politics that we hate. There was a soccer team of young females. Tell us about that.
And so we got.
That's a great story.
We got involved in that. In fact, there's a documentary called Ianda. And then there's a little mini documentary that WhatsApp produced called We Are Ianda that discusses a lot of this. But essentially, you know, my background, former personnel recovery, right, special operator as a pararescue man, former CIA operative. And I use the word operative, and a lot of people don't like that. Some of the, you know, CIA people who like primarily typed because it's a very true statement. One of the things that the war brought in was you had these organizations like the Central Intelligence Agency who had really reaped that peace dividend that Clinton was talking about. And so you had lots of academics, you had lots of brains and very little muscle. Now, what the special operations community had always had was the brains and the muscle. And so the CIA was forced, when the wars kicked off, to start poaching from the special operations community so that they could have that capability. Well, with that kind of background, when Afghanistan fell, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to imagine that I and many, many people, hundreds of people like me, started getting phone calls saying, hey, can you help? And that we had friends over there that we had worked with and all of that. So it started with just a call from somebody at the White House saying, hey, we're trying to get Americans out and people that America cares about. Can you pitch in and help out? I've got, I don't remember how many deployments to Afghanistan, a number of them, half a dozen or so. And I was just like, okay, well, I gotta pitch in and I gotta help. And had a nonprofit, you know, that focused on human trafficking. So I said, I will help personally. And then, and we were doing that. And then they said, well, hey, since you're focused on human trafficking, will you help get this girls? It was the Afghan girls national soccer team, right? So it's essentially the feeder for the national women's soccer team, which is their like Olympic soccer team. So I said, yeah, sure, absolutely, I'll do that. And we had this very, very good mechanism that was exporting people through a former CIA base. And I'm not saying anything classified. You can literally Google all this and read about it. But it was a great mechanism. It was just working. And then when those bombs went off and it caused an acceleration of the U.S. presence leaving, then that mechanism got shut down. And then we had to figure out how to get what essentially was hundreds of young or hundreds of people out. And it wasn't just evacuating the girls' soccer team, because the last thing that you want to do is take a bunch of young, naive girls, right? I mean, some of these girls were as young as, you know, 14 years old, a bunch of young, naive girls, and send them to a country where they don't speak the language and they don't have any resources and they don't know how to make decisions and they don't know how to read people. That sounds like a great way to get a bunch of girls trafficked. So I made sure that every girl had a caregiver that went with them. Most of them, it was the mother that went. Some of them, it was the father because they had dirtbag fathers, but most of them, it was the mother. Well, then was I really gonna ask a mother to leave her other young children? So then we said, any child who is under the age of 16 and male can come with you, and any girl under the age of 18 can come with you, right? Because 16-year-old men in Afghanistan, they can fend for themselves. In fact, quite frankly, they should pick up a rifle and start fighting the Taliban. So that's the way that we made that decision. Well, that went from a small soccer team to now over 300 people.
So wow. Good.
And so we, it was complete. The whole story is complete divine intervention. It was just God just providing just enough, just in time, every single time. There's this guy, Ray, he's an Afghan American. I've never met him in person. Just randomly, we got connected and he was able to solve all kinds of problems. We managed to move tons of money. There's a billionaire that I'd never met who ended up footing the entirety of the bill. Wow. So $2.7 million it took to evacuate these girls. And we didn't just evacuate them to some refugee camp somewhere, because that's not good either. No. Through an incredibly interesting set of events the reason I say divine intervention is because anybody who knows me knows I'm pretty good, but I'm not that good. I mean, we got these girls political asylum in Portugal.
Wow.
So they're becoming EU citizens. They're not there on a refugee status. They don't have to worry about getting deported. We also I can say it publicly now. There were some Christians that were hiding in the area, some young Christian girls, and I was asked if I would consider putting them in by there's just set of circumstances, and it just was kind of the right thing to do, even though it added a lot of risk to the mission, quite frankly. From my Nick McKinley operator hat was like, that was the wrong decision. My Nick McKinley trust in Christ hat, it was the right decision. Yeah. So it added a lot of risk. And I told the interpreter, I was like, you better tell those girls to learn to kick a ball quick. and so they ended up getting on the plane and getting evacuated too, which I obviously, as a Christian, believe one of the reasons why the mission was successful. It was the most successful private operation out of Afghanistan during the fall, was obviously because we had some of God's own in there. And and we're taking care of them as well. So
just a cool story. And just so the listener knows, we've had Nick on before. It's just the, you've done so many things. And, you know, when they give a dollar to the Deliver Fund, they need to know that it's supercomputers aren't cheap.
No, no. We are incredibly blessed. There's this amazing company here in Albuquerque, actually, that is, they was essentially part of the supercomputer team from Sandia National Labs. Mm-hmm. They left and they created their own supercomputer company. And to help people understand this, most people, when they think supercomputer, they think massive rooms with lots of servers and specialized infrastructure. And that's all true. Traditionally, that's what it was. These guys had figured out how to provision small supercomputers with commercial off-the-shelf parts that are about the size of a Keurig and run on wall power.
Oh, wow.
So revolutionary. We bought the very first one. That's kind of how embedded we are in the tech community, that we're buying the most bleeding edge hardware before anybody else even knows it exists. So of course they gave us a great discount, and they continue to support us in amazing ways. If anybody listening to this needs supercomputers to crunch data, they're called Hunify Technologies. They're an amazing company. Anyway, so but it's still you're right, it's very expensive. I mean, we spend over $1 million a year just on essentially ones and zeros, so just on computing. But that's what makes all of this work, and that's what's going to allow us to fight human trafficking at the scale of the problem. So we're just not constantly, you know, in this whack-a-mole scenario where you end up, you know, you hit one down and, you know, three more pop up. This is the ability to essentially, if you remember that old whack-a-mole game,
yes.
What we're doing is essentially putting a piece of plywood over the top. Nothing can pop up.
So good. Hey, so I asked you this once before, but if you could talk to the whole world, the rich of the rich to the poor of the poor, and give them a message, what would you give them?
Stop commoditizing women and girls. If we as a society stopped commoditizing women and girls, and I'm very specifically using the word commoditizing, not objectifying, and this is kind of controversial to say sometimes, but you can make an argument that women's like to be objectified in some circumstances. That's why there's makeup and high heels and diamonds and, you know, hair and all of that stuff, right? It's not that objectification piece, even though in many circumstances that goes overboard and it becomes wrong. That's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is the commoditization, treating women and girls as if they are a commodity to be controlled and to be sold and to be used. That's the biggest problem. And so that's, I think if we could have fathers instead of watching football and making lewd comments to their friends while their 16-year-old son is sitting there about those Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, if during that halftime show they just turn the TV off, right? If we had fathers setting better examples for their sons and their daughters, because oftentimes those fathers teach their daughters that they are commodities by the way that they say treat their wives or treat the other women in their lives, or they talk about other women. If we stopped that, we would see a significant reduction in demand and in human trafficking.
Well, and you and me are both married to very dominant, powerful women. We are.
How about dominant?
Oh, in a good way. It's
strong.
Yes,
very strong. Very strong.
Strong.
And I hopefully my daughters see that in my wife and the way we treated them. So that's pretty powerful.
It is. Well, and I just, as a mother of six daughters and four sons, one who is just started dating, and, you know, we're noticing things that we're like, oh, no, you wait a minute. No, you can't be mad about that. And, you know, just really having to step into that circle of not just saying, oh, here's the car keys, go take your girlfriend out on a date. You know, we have boundaries. We have, you know, there's a chaperone. There's this, there's that, there's, and it's work. It's a lot of work.
It's not
just, hey, we're just going to have all these kids and they're just going to raise themselves. And when they get 16, you know, like you had said, hey, they can just pick up a machine. That's not America, you know.
Right.
In America, there are things. And I actually have a brother that was abducted when he was 6 years or 9 years old. and fortunately returned. But, you know, so in my brain, all of my entire life, I have thought about and, you know, avoided, and we've always been around law enforcement and just really trying to safeguard our children. And we can't. It's just not possible to do that.
No.
And so what we have to do is we have to empower our kids. And, you know, we've had incidences. We've had to meet with, you know, administrators and, you know, headmasters of schools because there have been inappropriate things that our children have come home and said because we have tried to prepare them. And it absolutely floors me how many things and how many scenarios get swept under a rug because it's uncomfortable. And for me, I really just want to speak to parents that have the hard conversations, you know, tell your kids that these things are not only happening, but I know in our world, our kids are able to actually meet young ladies that have come out of this world and to have compassion for, but to also know that these weren't stupid girls.
Mm-hmm.
These were just girls that were or are just like them. And, you know, as a parent, I know as a mom listening to the podcast, I would be like, oh my gosh, what can I do? You know, you speak, you know, clearly to fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was raised by a single mother. We lived in motels. We were homeless. I was very much at risk. And I know in our home, we absolutely stand against. But what about a single mom that has three kids and
so that's a great question.
No father figure.
So here's Parenting 101 from the CIA.
Yes.
Well, large part of what we did in the counterterrorism fight was we would equip, train, and advise indigenous forces. Because, look, I was in a North African country where there was a big incident. You guys can figure it out from there. And there was just a few of us. So it doesn't matter how much training we have and how many guns we have. And I mean, when an entire country wants to go against you, you better have some numbers on your side. So we would use the locals and we would, you know, we'd basically bribe a warlord and we would then get his people and then we would equip, train, and advise them to be our force. Well, how is that any different with your kids, right? You equip them with the tools that they need. Right. And that can be things like if they have a smartphone, our HT Safeguard app that is, you know, technologies like Bark and Aura. And there's a bunch of other ones. Right. So you're equipping them with the things that they need. My guess is you probably equip them with a car with airbags.
Yes.
Because the technology is there. So you equip them, you train them in the way that you want to see them be brought up. Right. And then you advise them, you help them then make those decisions, and you teach them how to think through those issues. It's similar to any parent who thinks that they're going to be able to shelter their child from ever being exposed to drugs and alcohol. Well, that's just not reality. So you teach them to make good decisions when they face those things.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing with the internet, with social media. You teach them how to make decisions
when
something happens. And one of the biggest problems we have is called sextortion, right? Mm-hmm. For the first time in history, children, people under the age of 18, can take photos of themselves and then send them to other people. And because they grew up with the internet, it's like electricity. It's just there and they trust it and it's always going to be there and it's always going to work. Well, if they end up sending a photo to the wrong person, then that person ends up using that photo to extort them into giving them money or giving them more photos or something like that. So having a relationship kind of brings us back to the beginning of just being a good parent,
mm-hmm.
having the relationship with a child where the child knows that if they do something like that, they're not going to get in trouble. It's not going to be this big issue. You're there to help them solve that problem. And just in case anybody's listening, because I guarantee you at least somebody has had to deal with this, the way you deal with that is you call the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and you call your local law enforcement. And if one law enforcement officer won't pick up or won't take it seriously, you call the next one. Mm-hmm. And you just keep calling and calling and calling. You call the FBI, you call Homeland Security, you call the county sheriff, you call the city police, you call everybody. And then also an incredibly important part is the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, because they have, even though they're a private nonprofit, they have congressional authorities that mm-hmm. allow them to take essentially agent of the state actions to work with social media companies and internet companies mm-hmm. to get those images removed.
Excellent. Awesome. Now we know why Nick is a lion in the world. We're very thankful. Not only for you as a father and an example to us as men, but protecting our children.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate the work you guys do.
This episode was brought to you by Desert Sage Doodles. When your family's looking for more than a pet, go to DesertSageDoodles.com.